incredibly antiquated. It has no teeth. And for various reasons over the decades, it has never been enforced in Alaska.
A push to rewrite the Alaska National Guard's military code. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new theory on why the stellar sea lion population is struggling.
I think, and that's a bit of an interpretation, but I think that most likely Pacific sleeper sharks ate those stellar sea lions.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Enroll now in the Health Insurance Marketplace. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Open enrollment ends February 15th. Depending on your income, age, and family size, you may be eligible for discounts that may lower your monthly costs and out-of-pocket expenses. Pick a plan that is right for you and your family. Call 211 for free individual assistance about the Health Insurance Marketplace. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
Under the current Alaska National Guard rules, misconduct is only met with administrative penalties. Now, legislators are preparing to strengthen the code. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
For an hour and a half, Acting Adjutant General Mike Bridges walked the House State Affairs Committee through the problems with the Alaska National Guard's disciplinary system.
Alaska's military code was written in 1955 when we weren't a state. It has never been updated or truly affected or enacted since. It's incredibly antiquated, it has no teeth, and for various reasons over the decades, it has never been enforced in Alaska.
The deficiencies with the Guard's disciplinary process were laid out last year when an investigation by the Federal National Guard Bureau documented problems with sexual assault reporting, fraud, favoritism, and mistrust of leadership. The way the military code is currently written, a member of the Guard can be passed over for promotions or discharged from the service, but they can't be court-martialed in the way Army troops or Air Force members can. Bridges noted the Alaska Force has been working with Guard leadership at the federal level, along with the governor's office, to come up with a variation on the Uniform Code of Military Justice that would work for this state.
I call it a preventative measure. If folks know there's a big hammer waiting with a criminal charge to it for while they're serving in the militia of the state, the National Guard, they're going to probably think twice about it unless they're truly going to offend anyway.
Many of the questions Bridges fielded dealt with whether the federal code could simply be adopted wholesale. Representative Gabrielle Ledoux, an Anchorage Republican, also wanted to know if adopting the code could interfere with criminal charges being filed in the state court system. The answer was no.
We're going to call the cops anyway, ma'am. What this gives is the state government, besides just the law enforcement side, it gives us a military tool because we're militia to prosecute our, as a state UCMJ military code.
A bill to update the code has not yet been introduced, but the legislature's Democratic minority has announced plans to file such legislation. Meanwhile, Governor Bill Walker is planning to announce his pick to lead the National Guard on Friday. In Juneau, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
The CEO of Royal Dutch Shell says the company intends to return to the Chukchi Sea this summer to drill exploratory wells. But CEO Ben Van Beurden says Shell still needs permits, among other challenges.
Will we go ahead? Yes, if we can. That will depend on a number of things. First of all, will we be technically, logistically ready to go ahead? I'd be so disappointed if we wouldn't. We have been working on this for a long period of time, and we've kept all our capability in place, tuned it, upgraded it, just to be ready to drill this coming summer season.
Shell's last effort to drill in Arctic waters in 2012 was plagued by trouble, culminating in a drill rig running aground near Kodiak. One of Shell's subcontractors recently agreed to pay more than $12 million in fines for a range of environmental crimes. Van Beurden told reporters in London today the company will only proceed if it can do so responsibly. He also says Shell is as prepared as any company can be. At least five different federal agencies still must issue permits, and the Interior Department has to reapprove the lease sale after a legal challenge. A decision on that is expected in March. Van Beurden says Shell isn't deterred by the current low oil prices.
But if you look at the investment decisions, you cannot go by today's oil price. We have an investment wavelength of a decade typically in our upstream projects, so you have to take a view on what the oil price will be in the long run.
Still, Shell is holding its exploration budget flat, so this year's spending in Alaska will require cutting back on exploration in other countries. Returning to the Arctic means Shell would also be coming back to its support hub in Unalaska. The company left a mark on the town in 2012. The Noble Discoverer drill ship nearly ran aground there during a summer storm. Then, at its new moorage, it discharged oily bilge water into the bay. Unalaska Mayor Shirley Marquardt says she has lingering concerns.
We're not going to tolerate that type of behavior or operations anymore. We're supportive of Shell. We're supportive of what they bring to this community in terms of business opportunities, jobs, revenue. We just want them to know that we're not going to trade that, however, for turning a blind eye or just saying, oh, well, do whatever you need to do in order to take care of yourself. That is not what's happening.
The mayor says she's pleased Shell has made changes to its roster of subcontractors and added employees to work on environmental compliance. But if Shell does return to the Arctic this summer, the Noble Discoverer will be back. While Shell today announced it's investing in its Arctic prospects, ConocoPhillips Alaska says it's dialing back a bit. Conoco issued a statement saying it is slowing the pace of investment in its Greater Moose's Tooth project in the northeast corner of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Company President Trond Erik Johansson says they are deferring the final investment decision, but plan to shoot seismic over the area this year and continue engineering work. He cited permit difficulties and low oil prices. Just this month, the Corps of Engineers approved an 8-mile road for Greater Moose's Tooth and chose the route Conoco wants. The BLM, though, picked a different route and hasn't issued a record of decision. There has been plenty of money spent trying to figure out why the sea lion population in the Western Aleutians is not recovering. But nobody has put much money into studying sharks. The latest data from a study that implanted high-tech tags in sea lions suggests that maybe they should. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
These are not your ordinary wildlife tags. They are sophisticated pieces of equipment that record temperature, light, and other factors throughout an animal's entire life cycle. They float to the surface after the animal dies and transmit that recording by satellite to Oregon State University ecologist Marcus Horning. In 2005, Horning began tagging young Steller sea lions in Prince William Sound. And as those animals die, he's putting together a pattern that points to sharks, sleeper sharks, sometimes known as mud sharks, as the cause.
We don't have proof of sleeper shark being a major driver of the sea lion population, but we have indirect evidence that suggests we need to consider that.
Prince William Sound is a long way from the Western Aleutians, and Horning only has a small sample so far. His team tagged 45 sea lions, and by now 17 of his tags have popped up, indicating an animal died. Two did not hold their data set. The rest did.
In 15 out of the 17 instances, we actually got the full data set, so we can tell what happened to those 15 animals. And lo and behold, all 15 of those young sea lions died by predation.
All of them. They can tell that by the temperature and light recordings. They are warm and dark when they're implanted, but show changes when the sea lion dies or is consumed. And in four of those recordings, there's evidence of who the predator was.
I think, and that's a bit of an interpretation, but I think that most likely Pacific sleeper sharks ate those Steller sea lions.
As Horning says, that is interpretation. But the tags do provide enough information to use a process of elimination. If the sea lion dies and the tag is freed, it should show light. But if the tag shows continuing darkness, then the tag must still be inside somebody.
We think what happened is that those tags that remained dark were actually swallowed by the predator that killed the sea lion.
So that could have been any predator. But the four tags in question also show cold temperatures after the sea lion died. That eliminates warm-blooded predators like killer whales or great white sharks. but leaves cold-blooded, deep-dwelling sleeper sharks, nocturnal predators. If there's any scientist who knows about the mysterious sleeper shark, it's Bruce Wright of the Aleutian-Pribilof Island Association, who's been following Horning's work.
When I've looked inside of sleeper shark stomachs, I've found chunks of seal, big chunks of great whales, salmon, whole salmon that they've sucked down, adult salmon.
There is not much money to study sleeper sharks, but maybe there should be. Horning says all he's able to provide is a clue that they might be contributing to the sea lion's recovery failure. Just a clue that leads to a great many unanswered questions, like whether the predators have always been here or have expanded their range to include Alaska.
We also really don't know how many sleeper sharks are out there. Are their numbers increasing? Are their numbers decreasing? Which of the sleeper sharks are eating sea lions, if they do? Is it the big ones? Is it the medium-sized ones, small ones? Probably the big ones. Are there big ones in Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska? We don't know.
Horning says a study that showed no evidence of sharks consuming juvenile sea lions in the Western Aleutians does not rule out his theory. Sea lion would be a rare item in the shark diet because there are so few sea lions there, and nobody knows how many sharks there are. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage Police Department looks for a solution to a string of violent crimes in the city.
Something's going on in the drug world right now.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
A shooting in East Anchorage early this morning left a 20-year-old resident dead. It's the fourth homicide in less than a week, and the city's police department held a press conference this afternoon addressing a rise in gun violence this month. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Police Chief Mark Mew had his staff analyze how many violent shootings have happened this year compared to past Januaries. So far, they've doubled.
For the month of January, we had 31 of those occurrences. Of the 31, four were homicides, you know about those, and approximately a half dozen of them were other kinds of assaults where we actually have cases that we're working.
In total, the department has 10 cases under investigation, with suspects in several and leads in all of them. So far, drugs are the common element. Mew says marijuana, cocaine, methamphetamines, and pills have played a role in all but one of the cases.
Something's going on in the drug world right now.
Though it's too early to know for certain, Mew says some of the incidents appear to be related, involving gang activity and possibly retaliation. The department is putting together an in-house division made up of about a dozen officers pulled from different units. APD has also reached out to federal agencies to potentially coordinate on a task force, something that's worked in the past to respond rapidly to spikes in violent crime. It's an approach, Mew says, the department tried with success in 2007.
You know, we're going to be going out, contacting all those people, serving warrants like crazy, taking one thing from one step to the next, shaking down everything that moves on the street, and putting a lot of pressure on the criminal element that moves around at night and try and suppress this.
But some wonder if it's the right approach. Paul Honeman is an assembly member representing East Anchorage, where the majority of this month's shootings happened, and used to work for APD. He says without more resources from the city to adequately staff the police department, there won't be any long-term resolution.
Community policing is a philosophy that needs time in order to address problems, and we haven't seen that in a number of years. We've been barely keeping up with attrition. In fact, in some years, we've slipped.
And while most of the recent deaths and injuries may have had some connection to the illegal drug trade, Honeman says the problem is one that's felt community-wide.
Statistics and numbers mean something, certainly, but it's the perception of a safe community that's the most important. I think if people in our community don't feel safe, then they're not safe. That's in their mind. They feel concerned for themselves, their safety, their children, their families.
The biggest obstacle for detectives is getting good information in order to pursue leads. Mew says their resistance to cooperation from residents and witnesses has been frustrating and asks for anyone who may know something to contact police. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Common Core, the federally sponsored education standard adopted by many states, has raised the hackles of some Alaska legislators. Representative Laura Reinbold, a Republican from Eagle River, has been outspoken on the issue, and recently the Matanuska-Susitna borough has been drawn into the argument. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Last week in Palmer, the members of the Matanuska-Susitna Assembly and the borough's school board met in a joint session to hear about school standards. At the heart of the discussion, Common Core, a set of educational standards that has been voluntarily adopted by some states. Borough Mayor Larry DeVilbiss convened the information-only meeting.
I just want you to know this is not a gotcha moment. We're partners here together, and I think we all have the common interest of the very best education our kids can get.
DeVilbiss told Borough School Superintendent Dr. Dina Paramo that he wanted to know how closely the Borough School District is or is not aligned with Common Core. DeVilbiss said he'd gotten quite a few questions about it from residents. Paramo fielded the questions one by one in a presentation to the joint panels. Later, she said in a phone interview,
"If you put the Common Core standards and our state standards next to each other, they're going to be quite similar."
Paramo told the body that standards determine what expectations a student needs to meet, grade by grade. Curriculum is the means used to meet the standards.
And then we have 100% local control over writing the curriculum that would meet those standards. So what happens in the classrooms with how we teach, how we purchase textbooks, the materials that go with that.
Paramo says the Matsu School District matches Common Core standards in math and has found them to be more rigorous.
And in Matsu, we did only implement the math standards for Common Core.
The State Department of Education developed new standards in 2012, but opted not to adopt Common Core, according to Susan McCauley, Director of Teaching and Learning Support for the State Department of Education.
Those standards are significantly different than the standards we had previously in terms of, for lack of a better word, rigor. And there are similarities to the Common Core state standards.
The Council of Chief State School Officers and the National Governors Association devised the Common Core standards in an effort to create a uniform set of standards that would be the same state to state. To date, 43 states have either totally or partially adopted Common Core or are moving toward it. But some parents and some state legislators are apprehensive that Common Core represents the long arm of federal outreach. Eagle River Representative Laura Reinbold is one critic of the standards.
Do we want state sovereignty over education or do we want the federal government? I want state sovereignty over education.
Reinbold spoke at a Moose Lodge meeting in Palmer prior to the Matsu Assembly and School Board meeting, according to Borough Mayor DeVilbiss, in essence prompting many of the questions the mayor brought to the meeting.
One of my concerns is that this is the beginning of a progressive agenda that goes beyond math and English language and arts. We know that in the works there's history and science. I just hate to see a progressive agenda like this that has not been tested and which is actually being criticized by a lot of educators.
DeVilbiss also says the Borough Assembly needs to evaluate how much time and money is needed to exceed state educational standards. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil and Rasmussen Foundation.
Ketchikan High School's roof has become part of a NASA research experiment that could help scientists eventually predict earthquakes. KRBD's Ruth Eddy went up on the roof to learn why.
Metal boxes with magical little wires going every which way with like a giant antenna coming out.
That's what tribal scholar, program student Austin DeWitt Williams saw mounted on a wall on K-High's roof. In black lettering, one of the boxes reads, Global Earthquake Forecasting System. The equipment was designed by NASA and brought to Ketchikan through Trillium Learning, which brings real-time, real-world projects into schools. Trillium president Ron Fortunato joined the tribal scholar students on the roof to explain what those boxes are doing.
This is the magnetometer. You see how it's pointing towards the north. And what that does is it picks up those electrical signals from the tectonic plates. When they crush against each other, they release these electrons, and it forms that current. And that current comes up through the water. It can be measured hundreds of kilometers away even.
Other boxes are measuring gases.
Sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, ozone. All those things are pre-earthquake gases that increase when electricity comes up through the ground.
The forecasting system is one of three in the world. The other two ground stations are on top of schools in Kodiak. NASA researchers have been working on the science for years, using data from previous temblors to figure out what happens during an earthquake and if they might be able to use that information to predict them. Fortunato saw NASA working on the project and asked them what was next.
And they said, we need sensor stations that just have these pre-earthquake signal sensors on them. And we need them in very active areas. And I said, what if we could do it in Alaska? And they said, that would be the first choice, is to do it in Alaska.
According to the U.S. Geological Survey, Alaska gets between 1 to 200 earthquakes a day. Most of them are small, but it makes for an ideal place to test this new system. Fortunato says NASA has no obligation to work with students, but because of Trillium Learning projects in the past, they trust him, and they trust the kids, too.
They're not interns. They're actually required and responsible for producing data, information, maintaining the platform, doing the prototype development of the platform, things that NASA employees would do.
An obligation not lost on DeWitt Williams, who is nervous about messing up.
It's kind of like when you're on the bicycle and everyone's watching you, and this is like one of your first times riding it. You get to see it as everyone seeing you, everyone watching you intently, making sure you do well. And then you almost crash. You kind of waver. You get a speed wobble and you think, oh my gosh, everyone's going to judge me on this.
Fortunato says nerves are normal, but from his experience, kids involved in real-world projects like this learn quickly. On the first day, DeWitt Williams is still a bit unsure how to explain the project.
We're trying to, well, I guess, test the earthquake. I don't know how to put it in words.
One thing that he was clear about was that the science he'll be working on could help save lives. NASA still isn't even sure if it'll work, but they hope that the data these Ketchikan students collect can help scientists forecast earthquakes hours or possibly days in advance. In Ketchikan, I'm Ruth Eddy.
After nearly 30 years, the Anchorage Museum is preparing a complete renovation of one of its most visited areas, the Alaska History Gallery. It will be taken down at the end of summer 2016 and rebuilt from scratch. KSKA's Evan Erickson has more.
Since 1986, the sprawling Alaska History Gallery on the Anchorage Museum's second floor has offered visitors a treasure trove of artifacts and dioramas detailing a huge span of state history. The exhibit explores the ways of life of the land's earliest inhabitants to the birth of an oil-rich state. But in 30 years, much has changed in the understanding of Alaska history, as well as what might appeal to today's museum-goer. Katie Ringsmith is senior curator for the Alaska Gallery renovation. She says the gallery is one of the most popular tourist sites in the state, and that presents a challenge.
You have to go into it thoughtfully and respectfully. I think it's also important to seek insight from people who do know that gallery very well, and what are the objects that mean a lot to them and why, and how can you continue that, because if it works, there's a reason.
The overarching theme of the new installation is encounters, which the museum says will evoke the arrivals and departures of people in Alaska.
This idea, this notion that somehow we're this last frontier, kind of separated from the rest of the nation, you know, everybody's outside with a capital O. I think in some ways that's not necessarily the case. I think Alaska has been a bridge that has connected East and West, has been a bridge that has been a crossroads of culture for thousands of years. I mean, we're not the bridge to nowhere. We are the bridge.
The work on the new Alaska Gallery is being contracted to Montreal-based design firm GSM Project. Their design is expected to use interactive technologies to create a more immersive experience while retaining the spirit of the original collection. Some of the gallery's lifelike dioramas will likely be retired.
As my son calls them, statued people. So I probably will move away from the statued people. There's a lot of wonderful examples out there where history museums have done some pretty cool ways of immersing people, letting people to experience history in an immersive environment. Maybe it is feeling how Keegan Randall might ski down a trail at 70 miles an hour, what it might be like on the back of a Iditarod dog sled, or what it's like to catch a ball under the midnight sun, or catch fish in Bristol Bay.
With year-round visitors to the gallery comes wear and tear, so the museum will do a better job preserving artifacts in the new exhibit. Co-curator Aaron Leggett says that museum conservation has come a long way in the last 30 years.
Time has a way of wearing on the objects. I've seen pieces that were collected here in Cook Inlet from the mid-19th century that had fur on it. I know they had fur, but because of bugs and things, they literally have no more fur on them. So it's kind of an unfortunate thing. So, you know, you want to preserve them for as long as possible.
Leggett, a Denaina native, remembers visiting the Alaska Gallery as a kid and has worked on exhibit updates in the gallery over the years.
You know, I think the reason it took 30 years in one way is a testament to how successful it's been. I think that people have, it's a very cherished exhibit, and so I think that there's been a reticence to change it. Now we want to go in and really redo it, build it up from the ground up.
The $15 million project is scheduled to open in September 2017 to coincide with the 150th anniversary of the Alaska Purchase. In Anchorage, I'm Evan Erickson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Ellen Lockyer, and Evan Erickson in Anchorage, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Ruth Eddy in Ketchikan. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The state of Alaska reminds you to file online for your 2015 PFD on MyPFD. Paper applications are located at distribution sites in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.